Welcome to National Treasure Hunt, the podcast where the secret lies not only with Charlotte, but also with your co-hosts. I'm Aubrey.
And I'm Emily.
And today's episode is a pop culture comparison. Get excited!
Woo woo! We love our pop culture comparisons here on National Treasure Hunt, in case you haven't figured that out this season.
Yeah, I would say so much so that we're doing two in one season. That's, I think, rare for us.
I don't know if it's happened before.
Might be the first time, 8 seasons in. Today, we are talking all about Lara Croft Tomb Raider and, of course, comparing it to National Treasure. So, Emily, how good was Alicia Vikander, right?
Aubrey, what?
Alicia Vikander, the star of the movie.
Aubrey, I need you to tell me that you watched the correct version of this film. Alicia Vikander was not the star. I've never heard this person's name.
Calm down. I'm joking. I did not watch the 2018 remake this time.
Oh my gosh. Okay. That's a lot less stress on me because when I had to basically carry the Mummy episode because you had not seen Mummy 99, it was very stressful for me because I felt like I wasn't doing well.
I think I did us a favor because it turned out that Mummy 17 had way more National Treasure relevance than Mummy 99. But you
That
know
is true.
what? Today, I can't serve that role in the event that Lara Croft Tomb Raider 2001 doesn't give us what we need because we both watched the same movie this time, featuring Angelina Jolie.
Yes, featuring Angelina Jolie, just to be clear, in case anybody else wants to watch the film. Watch the right one.
Watch the right one. But, you know, if you haven't watched this film, don't forget, you don't have to have watched it to listen to this episode. We're going to give you a summary. We're going to hopefully explain things with enough clarity that you'll follow along, even if Lara Croft isn't your jam. But before we get into Lara Croft, Emily, we have to talk about Screams from Parkington Lane. Emily, how has National Treasure infiltrated your life this week?
Well, so this is actually one that I have had for a couple weeks, but there was a children's message at church. So basically the pastor just, kind of talks to the children, and he made this like video, and the message was about like the idea that you try but you don't always succeed when you make a promise. And somehow this related to balancing a board on bottle caps and then trying to put a soccer ball on it and
Okay.
seeing if the board would stay upright. And it did not. The soccer ball literally made the board tip, tilt, one might say. And I had flashbacks to the tilting platform from Book of Secrets. So that's where I was at during church.
You know what? I feel like knowing you personally, you've reached a new level of Parkington Lane, Emily. I feel like you've gotten a little bit deeper this week.
Yeah, it's now part of my anxieties. So we love adding more anxieties to my never-ending list. Aubrey, what were your was your scream anxiety related?
No, it's another dream.
Oh
It
my
happened
gosh.
just the other day. I blame it on the fact that at the time of this recording, we recently announced the date of our spring 2024 National Treasure Hunt tour. So, a couple days ago, I had a dream that I met Sean Bean in
What?
a like the hotel lobby car valet area, you know, like out front where valets will take your car. And I was getting my car, and I guess he was like getting his or something. And as we were waiting, I introduced myself naturally. And he ended up saying that he wanted to go on our tour.
Oh, okay. Well, Sean Bean, if you're listening and want to join our tour, please do.
Please do,
That would be
frankly.
cool.
Yeah. I mean, we do them twice a year. We'll do private tours, especially for you, Sean Bean. Naturally, Emily, you can imagine how disappointed I was when I woke up.
Yeah, I'm a little disappointed now.
Oh my God.
Not that I'm sure you're all cooler than Sean Bean for sure. And I know that because I'm gonna find out in like literally 3 days. So looking forward to it.
Amazing. So if you want to share screams with us or follow along on our tour this weekend, we will be posting all about it on social media.
Yes, you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at NT Hunt Podcast. We are also available at nthuntpodcast.com, where you can find out information about our tours and basically everything else there is to know about us. You can order our book, National Treasure Hunt, One Step Short of Crazy, at tuckerdspress.com. And you can also join our Patreon at patreon.com/nthuntpodcast. We have three different tiers, one of which is the Ben tier. And if you are part of the Ben tier, you actually receive a handwritten note from us with National Treasure Hunt stickers. So, like, do it because that's cool.
Given the timing of this episode, I'd also be remiss if I didn't mention that Ben's get a discount on their attendance on our tour. So
Ah, true.
keep that in mind. Well, at this point, for the fall tour or those in the future. But with that, I think we've gotten our business out of the way, and it is time to get into the meat of today's episode, comparing National Treasure to Lara Croft Tomb Raider, the 2001 film.
Yes, and as with all pop culture comparison episodes, I am going to be taking the lead on this one.
It's my literal biggest nightmare and fear.
So the outline for the episode is as follows. We will do a quick summary of the movie for those of you who have not seen it. And then we're gonna go into the kind of the meat of the episode itself. We're gonna be talking about comparing all of this to National Treasure, the protagonist kind of an antagonist structure that we see in these films. We're going to be talking about the underlying familial themes, which run throughout both films, spoiler alert. And we are going to be talking about what like makes a treasure hunt movie. That one we'll get a little more into when we get there, but suffice it to say, I'm excited for this because I kind of had like a moment of clarity, which led me to putting this in the episode.
Ooh, we love a moment of clarity, but we cannot get there without summarizing this movie, Lara Croft Tomb Raider, for our listeners. And Emily, just to scare you a little bit, I did watch this movie, so I will be able to tell if you mess up this summary.
Well, you won't be able to tell if I mess up this summary because I did the thing again where I used ChatGPT to give me a summary of the film because I did not trust myself to do it. So, this is quoted from ChatGPT. Tomb Raider 2001 is an action-adventure film based on the popular video game series of the same name. Side note, I was informed it was a movie based on a video game when Josh and I were halfway through the movie. Made a lot of things make sense for me. Okay, continuing. The movie follows Lara Croft, portrayed by Angelina Jolie, a fearless and athletic archaeologist adventurer on a quest to retrieve an ancient artifact called the Triangle of Light before it falls into the hands of the Illuminati, a secret society bent on world domination. If you listen to this podcast, I feel like you didn't need the Illuminati definition, but okay. Lara faces numerous challenges and enemies as she navigates through ancient ruins, battles mythical creatures, and uncovers the truth about her family's legacy. The film is known for its high-octane action sequences, Jolie's portrayal of the iconic heroine, and its blend of ancient mysteries with modern-day thrills.
Wow, ChatGPT, is that what the film is known for?
Yeah, I don't high octane action, maybe. So I was like, this is great, but we're gonna be talking about some other people.
Yeah.
And so I then asked if it could give me information about the other characters, like in a little summary form. So, other characters include Lord Richard Croft, Laura's father, played by John Voight.
John Voight! Oh my God, it's our first National Treasure connection.
He was an esteemed archaeologist and adventurer, to be clear, Richard Croft, not John Voight, who disappeared under mysterious circumstances while searching for the same artifact Laura seeks.
I know I'm getting ahead of ourselves here. I know there's more than one Lara Croft movie, even the Jolie version. Is this not saying that Lord Croft is dead because he like comes back in another movie? Because in this movie, we are meant to believe he is dead.
I thought he was dead.
Okay, me too. It says he disappeared.
He did disappear.
Okay, but this summary does not say that he is dead.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Okay, continue.
Fair, fair. Okay. Our next character is Manfred Powell.
Did not know that. Did not know that was this character's
I
name.
knew it was Powell, and the only reason I knew is because we paused the film so I could look up who the actor was because he looked so familiar to
He,
me.
this guy did look familiar, but
Yeah.
also Powell's the name of a henchman in National Treasure.
Very true. He was also in, so this actor was also, I don't know his name, but he was also in
It says it in your notes right here. It says his name is Ian Glenn.
oh, Ian Glen, yes. He was also in two episodes of Doctor Who, which is where I primarily know him from, as well as Downton Abbey for a little bit. So I know him from that. But in Lara Croft Tomb Raider, Powell is the main antagonist, who is a ruthless member of the Illuminati who seeks to obtain the Triangle of Light for his own nefarious purposes. Okay, I think
Deep.
he's just gonna use it, but okay. The next character is Alex West. He is played by Daniel Craig. That was a shocker to me.
He has no point in this movie whatsoever.
His point in this movie, and we will get to it, was to keep me somewhat engaged in the film until things fell apart.
Shots fired.
Yeah. Alex is a rival treasure hunter who initially joins forces with Lara.
He does?
Yeah, no.
I
But
missed
later
that.
betrays her in the pursuit of personal gain. So maybe initially in the sense of like they had a history.
Like pre-movie?
Yeah, we don't see them in the movie like working
No,
together
until the very end.
until the very end. Okay. Then we have Bryce, no last name. Lara's tech-savvy assistant, portrayed by Noah Taylor. Okay. He provides Lara with technical support and gadgets throughout her adventures. Cool. And then honestly, the last person's not super important, so I'm not even gonna say him.
Yeah, I was gonna say I didn't even know the guy's name was apparently Hillary.
Yeah. His name was Hillary. There's a guy named Hillary. He was a butler. He's not that important.
For the purposes of our episode, he's not that
Yeah.
important. I'm sure Lara Croft fans out there, you love this guy.
Yeah. And if you do, kudos. So with the groundwork laid, I think we're going to go ahead and we're going to jump into our first kind of main topic here, which is looking at the structure of protagonists and antagonists in both Lara Croft Tomb Raider and as it compares to the National Treasure franchise. So, Aubrey, did you have any initial thoughts on this?
I had a couple literally based on like the first scene that we see. I think the stage is set pretty quickly. Immediately we meet Lara Croft and she's like wielding two guns and is a far more traditional action hero right out the gates compared to Ben Gates, pun not intended.
Oh.
But also more traditional than Ben, or I should say Jess Valenzuela, since we should be thorough here. It also sets the stage because when we enter the movie, we enter on an action sequence, which is very different from National Treasure. We see Lara battling this robot, and we don't know what it is. We find out that it's like a game, like a toy. I'm guessing this is supposed to analogize very closely to the video game right off the bat. But before we know that she's doing this fake battle and that like this isn't a real bad guy, She's in this historical cavern with like all these artifacts around, and there's this robot. She is battling out with these guns. She's destroying things. The robot is destroying things. And I think this sets the stage for what sort of history adjacent protagonist we're working with. Someone who's not afraid to destroy the historical things. Now, before people come at me, I know it was a fake room, but it sets a precedent.
It does. And I definitely noticed that too. I was like, okay, we are just destroying things. So yeah, interesting. Interesting stuff. What about like the other characters?
Well, that's the other thing. It was almost disappointing. We then meet Bryce almost immediately, but then he doesn't factor in as much as I thought he was going to throughout the movie. When we meet him as the tech guy, he's of course the guy who designed the robot. He is giving Riley.
Yes, I literally have in my notes, quote, this guy with the robot has Riley potential.
Well, I mean, you called it right off the bat. It was immediate like sidekick vibes, tech guy vibes. Though I will admit, Emily, I don't know if you can relate to this. I don't fully understand who he is in relation to Laura slash why he's even there.
I think I just assumed he was like an employee.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, he sits in this room, it's like wall-to-wall computers, feels very security-esque, and he certainly seems to be the comic relief, but like he really isn't that important in the grand scheme of things. And I guess me coming in with a national treasure bent and knowing how integral Riley is to the treasure hunt and to basically everything Ben does, it set me up with this expectation, especially since we meet Bryce within the first 10 minutes, that he is going to have a similar critical role. And I don't think he has that.
No, he's definitely there, but I agree. He doesn't have like the same, critical.
Gravitas, maybe? Like,
Yeah, or just like importance.
yeah, importance of the plot. Well, speaking of. I think another really important difference between Bryce and Riley, because it is very tempting to call them equivalent as characters because they are both funny, they are both techie. Bryce doesn't actually seem to be doing anything meant to help the audience follow along with the plot. And remember, that is a critical role for Riley. As like breaking the fourth wall in a sense, like we know Riley was written to be the audience stand-in to help us understand what's going on. That role is clearly not Bryce's here. No one really has that role in this movie, despite the fact that it would have been really helpful.
Yeah, if anything, Bryce like confused me more.
Yeah, why?
I mean, it's gonna come up in a bit, but the movie confused me a bit.
Yeah, there are reasons for that, I think.
And I feel like, I don't know, Bryce just didn't seem like he was helping to explain anything to us or reacting like we necessarily would.
That's a good point. There are attacks on Laura and her estate, and he doesn't seem freaked out in the way that Riley would.
No, he's just kind of like, okay. And like, one could argue that's better, right? Like, you want someone who's, that works for you, I guess, if we're assuming that's the role, that doesn't freak out. But like, if we're looking for like a straight comparison to Riley, it definitely makes it more difficult to do that with Bryce.
I think there's another big difference as well, but and it comes when you start comparing the Ben Riley dynamic themselves to the Laura Bryce dynamic. I think it can be tempting early on to see Bryce as someone who uses his tech to guide Laura in, her day-to-day adventures. Specifically because there's this one scene where the bad guys, we find out later they're the Illuminati, right? They are descending upon the estate and like crashing through the windows and doors and attacking Laura from every direction. And Laura has to make her way over to an earpiece, put it in her ear, where then Bryce can tell her, like, oh, the guy's here, the guy's there, like, dodge, whatever. And I think immediately I was like, oh, wait, the Galahsine, right? Like, Riley in Ben's ear. But there's a big difference here that is, it's subtle but important. Did you notice this?
I think I know where you're going.
Okay, so. And the Galahsine, Riley is in Ben's ear to guide him through situations proactively. He's helping him get, to the or through the area where the password has to be typed in. He's guiding him down the hallways to get to the preservation room, basically helping him navigate before the bad guys arrive. They have a very proactive, planned, synergistic dynamic. Whereas Bryce isn't working with Laura in that way. He's not helping her devise her plans or guiding her through her plans. His role is entirely to get Laura out of the situation with the bad guys reactively.
Okay, that's not what I yes.
What were you thinking? I'm curious.
I mean, it's dumb, but I was thinking the like Riley's better at tech because the earpiece that Lara was using looked kind of like the microphones that we use, and Ben's you couldn't see.
Okay, well, 2001 versus 2004, I imagine the tech was a little bit different. We did spend an entire episode early this season thinking about the evolution of technology from the cost standpoint, and perhaps this is just an evolution of 3 years in modern technology.
It's possible. But yeah, no, that's a really interesting point. I like that a lot, and that's definitely a different it's a different dynamic between our main protagonists. I mean, I hesitate to call Bryce a main protagonist, but I don't really know who else is if not him.
That's a very good point. Very good point.
Okay, so we talked a bit about like Riley, right? And whether or not we can kind of create an argument for Bryce being Riley. I think it's pretty obvious, right? As we said, that Laura is giving Ben,
Right,
right?
for sure. It was so obvious we didn't even say it.
Yeah. And so I guess like what about her kind of gives us Ben if we're trying to think about the protagonists in these films.
Well, I mean, she's not only like the main title character, but she is, has archaeologist vibes. She is a treasure hunter. She has a lot of unique skills that make her the one who can solve this particular treasure hunt, I would say.
Yeah, and I noticed that too. She was very much the person who was able to solve the clues. I mean, they didn't really give anyone else a chance, I will say.
Right.
But there were clues, and she solved them.
Yeah, one that comes to mind for me is at one point Laura receives a note from her deceased father, Lord Croft, and the note is it actually reminded me of the meerschaum pipe in a way because it is basically an instruction in the form of a riddle. And it was very clear that Laura can Only Laura can understand its meaning. Like she reads the note and then, without hesitation, this was also very unclear to me, but without hesitation, she goes into the library or the study and picks out a particular book and flips it to a particular page to find a longer message from her father. And so I very much got the impression that the note was almost like a code word or a riddle of sorts that only she would understand, just as only Ben is. In National Treasure World, he is shown as the only one of the search party to be able to understand the full meaning of the riddle on the meerschaum pipe. And then, just to keep the analogy moving, the pipe message directs him to the Declaration of Independence, where there is also a much longer message, kind of like what Laura experienced.
Yeah, no, that's so true. And I mean, I Totally agree with that. I really like that she was able to solve the clues. I will say one thing that got me in trying to like paint her as the kind of like protagonist of this film in comparison to Ben is like Laura is clearly rich. Okay? Like she lives in a mansion. Okay, it's basically what we see like Ben and Abigail move into at the end of National
No, it's
Treasure.
bigger than that.
Oh, for
It
yes. But
is
I was just,
unrealistically large.
it is unrealistically large, yeah. And we'll get to realism a little later on. I feel like we that Ben isn't like struggling
I don't think
financially.
he's struggling at all. I just don't think he owns a mansion or has the capability of
Yes.
owning a mansion.
And if he did, I feel like we would have had a little bit of information about how, like, right, like the reason he and Abigail were able to get that house at the end was because they had found this treasure, right?
Right.
They had the means to do so. Same thing with Riley and his car. And maybe this is part of the video game, I don't know, but like, we as an audience of this movie have no idea where Laura's money has come from, and it is odd to me. I will say, if we are trying to make like a direct Ben parallel, she does have the confidence that Ben has, which I really, really like from like a strong female character perspective. So one example that pops out to me immediately is when she goes to the auction. Do you remember this auction scene that she attends? It's pretty early on in the film. She's like sunglasses
Vaguely.
on.
Yeah, 'cause she's going there to meet with someone, right? Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And so she's like bidding on this item, but she goes into that room. She is late. Like the auction has begun. She pulls an empty chair from the row in front of her and puts her feet on it. And like you see people looking at her and kind of being like, okay, but like she does not care. She just has that confidence to like, yep, I belong here. I'm gonna do what I want.
Okay, you describe that as confidence. I almost describe it as arrogance. I do think that she and Ben share confidence, especially in their abilities, but I do think that it is portrayed in very different ways. I think she comes across as a lot more smug about it, which I'm not going to be mad about because we love a confident woman lead. But let's just put it this way. If Ben acted the way she acted in terms of even just that example of pulling the chair up to put her feet on, people wouldn't like Ben as much.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't probably.
I wouldn't either. I don't think anyone would because it would come off as like super smug.
Right. Yeah. No, that's a good point.
So the last thought that I had about Lara specifically, thinking about how she is, as we've argued, the equivalent to Ben in this case, and the movie came out, just 3 years before National Treasure. So we're talking temporal consistency here. And we're coming off of a more recent era where National Treasure tried to have its own female lead in Edge of History with Jess Valenzuela. And it had mixed results in terms of whether or not it was successful. Watching this movie made me question, is this what National Treasure should have looked like? With a female lead? Like, is this the vibe that an Edge of History, quote unquote, should have taken? Or even if we had seen, let's say, not like the young serial version of National Treasure in Edge of History, if we had gotten like a movie in 2023 that was National Treasure with a female lead, would it have looked something like this with this Lara type character?
Yeah, that's a really interesting thought, actually. I hadn't considered that. I will say that I don't know if we as a society, you and I might have been, but as a society on the whole, were ready for a female-led National Treasure in 2001.
But this is a female-led national treasure in 2001, effectively.
It is. Something I found deeply concerning about this essentially female-led National Treasure was that there was a good amount of unnecessary sexualization of Laura.
Ding, ding, ding.
And so, like, I'm not gonna go into my whole like patriarchy corner here, but I did like there was one scene in particular pretty early on where Laura is taking a shower. There's no plot reason that she is like needs to be shown taking a shower, but she is shown taking a shower and then shown coming out of the shower. I literally have written, I'm not confident that people watched this movie for the plot. Like, yeah,
Interesting.
it felt unnecessary and weird, and it didn't need to be there. And so that concerns me a little bit if we're thinking about what a female-led national treasure, right, would look like in that time period. Like, maybe it's better that we waited. I don't know.
That's a
Like,
really good thought. That's a really good thought.
yeah.
I'm gonna have to sit with that one.
Okay. So while you sit with that, we're gonna move on to our antagonists. Okay.
I am so ready to talk about the antagonists because while the protagonists in Lara Croft like scream National Treasure movie analogies to me, the antagonists scream even louder of Edge of History comparisons to me. Did this happen to you?
Yes. And I think we are talking about the same or thinking about the same thing here, but I would l go ahead and tell me what you're thinking.
Okay. It really boils down to one big thing, and then there are like our sub antagonists, like Daniel Craig, who has no point purpose in this movie. But like the big, don't look at me like that. His
We
character
already talked
has
about his purpose.
to keep you entertained. He could
Yes.
have been completely deleted from this movie and the plot would have ran the exact same
And I
way.
would have not finished it.
Oh my God, you would have for a National
I
Treasure
was
hunt.
very close to not Aubrey. It was painful for me.
Wow. Okay. We'll get there. We'll get there. We're getting ahead of ourselves. Take a breath. Okay. Are you thinking about the board of old white men that pop up very early on in Lara Croft Tomb Raider? I was immediately like, oh my God, this is the Edge of History board of old white men at Cross S Nostrum. You get the vibe immediately that this is a group of bad guys who are, in this case, after the, what is it, light of the triangle, triangle of the light, the two halves of this triangle thing they need to find. And we don't know why at first, which is very much like the Cross S Nostrum board. I would argue that for Cross S Nostrum, we never actually learn why the board is there, and what they want, exactly what their roles are. But that was the immediate parallel to me.
Yes.
And then we find out that the board is the Illuminati, and I literally started cackling. I have no idea why that was so funny to me. Like, the first thing I thought was, it's really strange to me how few movies in the grand scheme of things try to put like faces or motives on the Illuminati, or like try to portray the Illuminati in some way, given how ubiquitous the Illuminati is in like prevailing ethereal discourse. This was the first time I've ever seen it in a movie, and I just found it hilarious for some reason. I don't know.
Yeah, it was great. I think I will say that the Edge of History vibe that these old white men were like giving you, very much they were giving me the same vibe. I was definitely thinking like Cross S Nostrum. Something that stood out to me that felt a little weird was the idea of Laura needing to destroy essentially the treasure, the two pieces of this triangle, right, that allow you to have the power to like harness time. And so the idea that the triangles were split in two is something that is discussed in the film, and it was done so that no one person could have all the power. Like, that's very Knights Templar, you know, Freemason, National Treasure stuff. But then Lara needs to destroy them in order to keep them safe. They're clearly
Keep
like
who safe?
to keep like society safe. The triangles or the pieces of the triangle are clearly supposed to be the treasure in this film, but Lara is supposed to destroy it. And that feels very Crossus Nostrum coded to me, kind of harkening back to, the Crossus Nostrum episode that we put out recently, where, like, is it an antagonist? Is it a protagonist thing? Like, who is Crossus Nostrum in, day-to-day life? I will say the triangle thing, like, there's some history there, but it's not the same kind of history that we talk about with National Treasure. So I guess that the argument could be made that like destroying it is okay. But even that to me sounds like I am now supporting Crossus Nostrum, which I don't want to. So.
Well, no, this is so interesting because I didn't clock this when I was watching the idea that Lara effectively has to destroy the treasure. That is such a good point. And it really adds to this idea of a Cross S Nostrum. You know, if we're comparing this to Edge of History, it adds to the idea of Cross S Nostrum not being so black or white in terms of their motives, right? Because in this case, we have a protagonist who's destroying the treasure, not an antagonist. The thing that stood out to me with the triangle, Emily, I don't know if you clocked this one, was the point, you know, in the historical background that they give us, this triangle was once in one piece and it was split in two because, you know, in order to kind of protect its power, the power of this treasure, and you'd have to put it back together to, in a sense, re-access the treasure, this power to control time. To me, it went beyond Cross S Nostrum at that point and was really hearkening back to the Daughters of the Plumed Serpent taking the map leading to the Pan American treasure and breaking it into the three boxes. And like each one box doesn't do anything for you, just like one half of the triangle doesn't do anything for you. You have to put it all together to actually get your map or get your power or get your treasure.
Ooh, okay. I did not think of that, but love that. Fantastic. Love it.
Amazing.
Okay. So you keep on Alex, who is played by Daniel Craig.
I do.
He's an antagonist, but like, why do you, what's your deal?
Okay. Well, from a story perspective, I maintain that he has no real relevance to the story. His character is not explored nearly enough to make his arc make any sense. But from the get-go, I really even couldn't even tell what his deal was. Like, was he a rival, quote-unquote, Tomb Raider? According to ChatGPT, apparently the answer is yes. Also, while I'm at it, why do they keep using the term Tomb Raider? I know it's because of the video game name, but I think they're using it to be synonymous with Treasure Hunter, which personally I disagree with. Anyway, Daniel Craig is obviously a villain here, but I couldn't even tell what his relationship was with the Illuminati because he was clearly helping them. But in any case, just to go one step further, I will say that he has a National Treasure parallel in that he has Ian Howe's motivation because Daniel Craig, Alex, clearly states that he is quote unquote in it for the money. So it's giving pure Ian Howe, pure classic villain. But a less compelling Ian Howe because he's not in control of anything happening from the villainous side of things. He's just kind of along for the ride.
Okay. Yes,
Cannot disagree with that.
no, I agree. I agree with that. I agree with that. I do. I was interested because it was Daniel Craig and he was cool. And I was like, ooh, love story. I guess this is interesting.
But it was barely a love
Oh,
story.
I know, Aubrey. I
Okay.
know. I find love stories anywhere. I've been told there's not a love story in Lord of the Rings, and there very much is. So like I it's there. Speaking though of Ian Howe from National Treasure, I will say that I noticed some of our antagonists with a little bit of a similarity to Ian. The men that were working for Powell, who was the guy that you said you did not know his name,
Oh yeah.
who is part of the
Like the
Illuminati,
real villain? Yes.
the real villain, yes. They have a scene where they are it is clearly meant to set them apart as antagonists. So it's that weird scene that you mentioned a little earlier, where Laura is doing that weird like rope work jumping thing in her mansion. Like, do you remember the scene?
I do. She was
It
like,
was weird.
at first I thought she was doing that really cool, it's like an, I think it's like an exercise or like a dance type of thing where people use like the ribbons hanging from the ceiling. You know what I mean? Like it's like a very aerobic or acrobatic type of thing. It wasn't.
No, I still don't know what the point was, but she was doing it. Plot, probably. And so, as she was doing these exercises, let's call them, there was this very like peaceful piano music that was playing. And this was contrasted by any time they showed Powell's men breaking into her mansion, we heard this super heavy like rock music. And then they'd go back to Laura and it would be this like chill piano music and then go back into rock. And this to me just screamed like Ian's men trying to steal the Declaration versus Ben trying to steal the Declaration. And like the fact that the music supported this was kind of cool to me.
All right. I mean, I expect nothing less from you to pull in music where appropriate.
And so I do want to bring back kind of this concept that we were talking about with Laura very at the very top of this antagonist section, where I was kind of saying that there was this relationship possibly between her destroying the triangle and Crossus Nostrum. So like Laura is clearly the protagonist, but did you have any other like kind of conflicting feelings about her?
Aside from the smugness that we said we're not going to judge her for, you know, Daniel Craig's character did point out in his perspective that Laura, her motivation is being in it for the glory. And gosh, doesn't that scream Mitch to you?
Ooh, yes, it does.
You know, because Mitch, his whole thing was like putting the Wilkinson name in the history books. I think that is a synonym for glory. And you know, come to think of it, having watched this movie, I have no idea why Laura is doing what she's doing, aside from the fact that her dad kind of told her to. So I guess I'm inclined to believe Daniel Craig's interpretation. Maybe he's trying, maybe his, the fact that he even had that line was the creative team's effort to tell us what her motivation was.
Okay, that's possible.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm not going to say that glory is a bad motive necessarily, but the fact that in this national treasure sphere, we associate the motive of glory to be a little bit less noble and compare it to Mitch. Mostly because Ben never seems to be doing it exclusively for the glory himself. I think that does paint Laura in, let's just say, not as noble of a light as someone like Ben.
Yeah, definitely for sure. I completely agree with that. And so, thinking about the people that we are clearly supposed to identify as the antagonists, you kind of mentioned this idea earlier on about Laura's like live-in, presumably assistant person, the Riley-esque Bryce character, being like helping her in a way that's different than how Riley helps Ben, like almost retroactively helping her in a way. And I didn't know if you felt that way about like our antagonists at all, how that like timing played into things.
I certainly got the feeling that the protagonist antagonist treasure hunt dynamic was quite different in Tomb Raider compared to National Treasure. I mean, we've said it 8,000 times on National Treasure Hunt. In both movies, it's like a calling card of a National Treasure villain to be a step behind the protagonist, to effectively be following the protagonist around, especially in the second movie, right? But in Lara Croft, did you get this impression that Lara is kind of following the villains? She's a step behind the Illuminati at all times. Like they're always in the place she then figures out she has to go. Then she goes, she sees them there. There's some sort of altercation. They go on to the next thing. She has to meet them there. Like she's always behind.
She is always behind. Yeah, that's a great point.
I mean, no
Very interesting.
judgment. She is effectively working entirely by herself since we've decided Bryce isn't really helping her on the treasure hunt. But it is a very different structure than we're used to.
Yeah, I agree with that. Okay.
But just as different as that is, it is also worth coming full circle and saying National Treasure, the protagonist and antagonist work together in the final scenes. And we get that here. So there is that conserved MO that I think is a pretty interesting or a different dynamic. If this were a Lara Croft podcast, for example, we might take the time to figure out if the dynamic makes sense for Lara to work with the villains, frankly, for the villains to want to work with her, because up until this point, they've proven themselves to be ahead of the game compared to her. And therefore, I almost don't buy it that only she can solve the clues, because, like, then how did they get this far on their own?
Ooh, good point.
You know, the National Treasure version of this makes more sense to me, I guess.
Yeah. And the last thing I'll say on this is, speaking about antagonists and protagonists, I think we can both agree that Water was still a villain.
Oh, yeah, it was.
Okay, so on that note, we're going to move on to our second section. These next two ones are going to be actually like a little shorter. That was kind of our bulkier section here. But our second section is talking about the underlying familial themes that are in both Lara Croft Tomb Raider and National Treasure. So, Aubrey, I think we can both agree because we literally both said this in our separate notes. Family is the main drive in this movie.
I mean, this is what makes Lara Croft and National Treasure comparable, in my opinion. Like it's we actually had a lot of good comparisons so far, but like this is the biggie. And let me get this out of the way right from the beginning. Lord Richard Croft, Lara's dad, is played by Angelina Jolie's real dad, Patrick Gates. Yes, I said Patrick Gates because Patrick Gates is Angelina Jolie's dad. So like you can't get more much more like family vibes than a literal family portraying the family characters. And
True.
then it just continues with the storyline.
It does. So yes, Aubrey, I agree. I think it starts with Lord. I can't call him Lord Richard. I'm just gonna call him Patrick. I
Oh my God,
think
no,
it.
it's gonna get really confusing.
Okay, I think it starts with Laura's dad's career, maybe.
Yeah, I mean,
Speak to that.
I can. I mean, it is hard to speak to when, quite frankly, I could not tell you what his profession was. Astronomer, question mark, cosmologist, question mark, something else entirely. I really don't know. However, he is certainly historically based to some extent, but more importantly, he has the background in whatever he
Whatever he
and
needs to.
right, whatever he and his family need to have background in to pursue this treasure. And the treasure hunt is clearly like the family business. Lord Richard Croft ultimately influences his daughter's career and actions, I would say, in the exact same way that the Gates family influenced Ben to pursue the Templar treasure. The only real difference here is there was a hot second where Patrick Gates wasn't in on this vibe because he had given up, but that lasted all of 30 seconds in the grand scheme of things. What? Am I wrong?
No, you're completely correct. I just like that you were like, there's a scene where Patrick just like wasn't on board, but Yeah, I mean, it's true.
Yeah. I think so. I think so. So one thing I want to point out is that Jon Voight was in, or was filming Lara Croft approximately 3 years prior to filming National Treasure, and his character is very similar in both. I would love to know, now that I'm thinking about it, like what he might have taken from this role in Lara Croft into National Treasure. Because I don't know about you, whenever I saw Lord Croft on the screen, I was like, Patrick?
He, so yes, his voice did not sound the same.
Really? I thought it did.
No, it sounded weird to me. But yes, I do think it would be interesting to know if he like took any influences
Yeah.
kind of from this filming for sure.
Well, I mean, if there are a number of things that I saw in Lara Croft where I was like, wow, if you had told me National Treasure came 10 years after Lara Croft, I would have believed you if you told me that the National Treasure story was like intentionally replicating or recreating bits and pieces of Lara Croft as like a nod, because there was so little time between the two. I don't think that happened here. But for example, Lord Croft tells effectively this long story near the beginning of the movie, kind of explaining the history of the triangle. And it was so similar to the opening scene of National Treasure, where John Adams Gates tells the story of the Templar treasure. Like the structure is so similar there.
Very true. So I also noticed that based on the clue that Laura's dad left her, Laura had to like cut into a book in
Yeah, we
order
talked
to.
about that, the scene from a few, I guess, like 20 minutes ago.
Yeah. That to me was very like reminiscent of Patrick and Ben with the common sense, like the Thomas Paine book, because it was
Oh,
the book was kept at Patrick's house.
that's fun.
Yeah, so I don't know. Well, that was cool.
But then, okay, to me, the biggie here is the bad guy. What's his name again?
Powell.
Powell, right. Powell telling Laura. Spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't watched this movie, this is kind of like a big twist. Powell tells Laura near the end of the film that her father, Lord Croft, was actually part of the Illuminati.
Rough stuff.
It immediately, my brain was like, Mitch saying Thomas Gates was the artifice of the John Wilkes Booth conspiracy.
Yes.
Did you get that too?
I did.
Okay,
Yes. It was
thank
very,
God.
it was, yeah, it was very obvious.
It's this idea of changing the protagonist's perception of the thing that motivates them the most, their family.
Yeah.
Right. But then the difference becomes later on, at the very end, we discover in National Treasure, Thomas Gates was never a bad guy. But I think if I interpreted it correctly, we learned that Lord Croft really was part of the
I don't know. Okay.
Illuminati. I'm so confused.
This movie confused me. I understand that there was this family connection, but honestly, it's still unclear to me why Lord Croft was involved in this at all, and then why Laura became involved in tomb raiding, I guess we call it, before getting like this message. I just like short-circuited. This message from her dad. I mean, I think this is underscoring how I don't super understand this movie. I would assume that part of the reason she's a Tomb Raider is because her dad went missing, but like that's not explained in the film. So maybe it is in the video game. I don't know. But also people skip through those backstories in video games. So I don't know that they would have known.
Well, ultimately, I agree that it was confusing, but if I interpreted this correctly and he really was part of the Illuminati, I don't know if we're meant to believe that maybe the Illuminati had some good people in it in this world. Once again, kind of messing with our conception of good guy versus bad guy. Or I feel like this might be the right interpretation, but I didn't see enough on screen to convince me fully. Maybe Lord Croft was a part of the Illuminati because he thought it was actually like noble for some reason to analogize it to national treasure, like to be part of this, like a Freemason society or something. Maybe they had noble goals. But then as he was part of it, he learned that they were actually nefarious. And then he kind of wanted out. But by wanted out, I mean he wanted to destroy the triangle. And that's why they killed him.
Ooh,
I
yeah.
think that's right because we did see that ending scene where Powell was like, "Your dad begged for mercy," and I think we saw that Powell shot him.
We did. Yep. That was a random scene that I felt was kind of thrown in there and violent to say the least. But yes.
Okay, so I've gotten us a little bit off track, but now that we've discussed the interpretation of the ending of this movie, should we get into that final convo you wanted to have about like what makes a treasure hunt movie?
Yes. Let's do it because I think that there are some like basic characteristics that we see across National Treasure and across Lara Croft. Then there are some that we see in Lara Croft and the other movies we've been doing comparisons to National Treasure with, but not in National Treasure.
Oh,
And so
interesting.
I want to kind of talk about like why National Treasure feels like it is a treasure hunt movie. And spoiler alert, most of these other films, including this one especially, did not feel like treasure hunt movies to me.
Okay, I'm really curious because I feel like this one felt more treasure hunty than a lot of the ones we've done previously. So this will be interesting. Can I start with getting an obvious one out of the way?
Let's do it.
Symbology. Like, I know in the case of National Treasure and Lara Croft, they both center frequently around the all-seeing eye. But it doesn't, but for the record, it doesn't have to be an all-seeing eye. Like, symbology seems important to a treasure hunt movie.
Yes, definitely. Symbology seems important. I honestly, I noticed this too. I literally have written in all caps in my notes, all seeing eye, because I was like, yes. And I actually knew that it was the Illuminati before they said it, because that's a symbol of the Illuminati.
Oh, I had
Yeah. So like that to me, I was like, oh, I bet they're gonna do this. And then they did, and I felt smart. But yes, symbols, super important. I think 100%. They are a big part of treasure hunt movies. Let's go to your favorite,
no idea. Oh, God.
supernatural elements, Aubrey.
Supernatural elements are so not important to make a treasure hunt movie. However, they are very common because they make it easier to explain away fun action adventure-y things like ghosts and like mystical, spirity, supernaturally things that can guard a treasure. But whew, calm down, Aubrey. Whew, calm down. I think my thesis here is supernatural elements are not necessary to create a treasure hunt movie, but they are common because they are easy. In this movie, in Lara Croft, there's like a really big cosmological, astronomical undertone. I mean, early on, we see Lara using this massive telescope, which, if her estate was unrealistic, this telescope was as unrealistic, if not more, in my personal opinion.
Yep.
And, you know, she's talking about an impending eclipse. And the board of old white men, the Illuminati men, are talking about how the planetary alignment has to be just so in order to secure the two halves of the triangle. And so and when they're doing certain activities on the treasure hunt, they have to put like a clock into a dial and do things at specific times aligned with this eclipse or the planets. And this is very different from National Treasure, obviously, but I will say, I will admit that there is a slight Edge of History vibe just because of Edge of History's star map. So I don't think that astronomy inherently makes a treasure hunt supernatural. Actually, in the beginning, when she's talking about the eclipse and astronomy, I was actually intrigued because I was like, we're using science to motivate the treasure hunt now? That's cool.
We do like that.
Right. But as soon as we start learning what the treasure is, what the triangle is, this is where it becomes supernatural again. And I was disappointed
Yeah.
because you alluded to this before, but the triangle of light gives its owner the power to control time, which is supernatural.
Yeah. And how did you feel about the statues?
This is the other thing. So when they're in Cambodia, which by the way, loved the Cambodia angle, I feel like ancient Asian cultures and whatnot are not represented in treasure hunt movies as much as they very well could be. They're in this like cavern. It's one of the early steps of the treasure hunt, where I think they're going to end up securing the first half of the triangle, if I'm remembering correctly. But they're in this cavern and these statues come to life. And then there's this quote unquote pure light that kinds of like shoots out of the wall or something, and it creates this liquid that looks kind of like mercury, and it's that mercury liquid that brings them to life. And I'm like, you didn't have to do this.
Did not have to do that.
I would have been so on board if they gave just purely astronomical rationale for why they had to do things when,
We
because
like
that would have felt very analogous to like the Mesoamerican cultures that we've talked about.
And I feel like we had enough bad guys.
Yeah, we didn't need to like come
We
to life
didn't need, yeah,
statues.
no. Honestly, that gave me very like whatchamacallit, Indiana Jones slash like the Mummy vibes.
Yes.
So
Very
I'll
mummy. Very mummy.
very mummy,
Agree.
yes. Both mummies. I will say that, like, in general, I am a fan of like supernatural stuff and like futuristic technology, but even this for me was like a bit much. And I think this was kind of my turning point in wanting to have this conversation because as soon as the movie started with like the robots, I was immediately thrown off. Like, that's not what I come to a treasure hunt movie for. I don't come for robots unless we are fully set in the future, which it was very clear that we were not. I do not like, there should not be robots. And like, I'll just say to add some humor before we move on to our next like subcategory here. From the beginning of the movie, my notes in order are, quote, wasn't expecting robots. This is dumb. There better be a love story. It was all a simulation. That's dumb.
Okay, I feel that entirely. However, you know that whole opening scene was just a throwaway, like a nod to the video game people who came from the video game world. Like that was meant to be like a video game setting, and you can easily cut out that whole opening scene, start at the next one, and you'd still have a perfectly, I would say, perfectly logical movie insofar as this movie is logical.
Sure, yeah. I think there was enough action other places that I just felt like this was a lot, but I understand, yeah, like where you're coming from with the nod here. So this next section kind of directly ties into the supernatural stuff in general, and that's like how much a treasure hunt movie is grounded in reality and whether or not we think this is important for a treasure hunt film. So, Aubrey, like, if you were to look at National Treasure compared to Lara Croft, what would you say in terms of how grounded in reality these things are?
Lara Croft is not grounded in reality at all.
Yes.
Like, at all. I mean, from the perspective of the fighting robots to all the supernatural elements that we just discussed, it's not grounded in reality. But for me, I almost am not mad at the fact that, like, we have no idea why Lara is so rich and has this estate and blah, blah, blah. It's annoying, but I can get past that not realistic bit. What I can't get past is when the characters, well, there's two things. One, when the characters don't react in realistic ways, when they're very clearly existing in what is supposed to be like the planet Earth. It's not like some random world, right? That is totally fictional. So, like, for example, when the bad guys are ambushing Lara at her estate, we've talked about this scene a number of times. She's just like unusually, unrealistically calm. Bryce
Yeah.
also wasn't really freaking out. Ben, Riley would have had very different reactions. Actually, there's one scene that came to mind in particular. You know, in the first movie in Philly, when they split up and Ben is running with the poster tube and Phil is chasing him like through the cemetery, and then he gets to the gate and Ben like holds the gate. He realizes it's locked and he literally like rolls his eyes.
Yeah.
Like, to me, that is such a genuine reaction of like, you've got to be kidding me. You don't get that at all in this movie. So that bugs me. But then for the treasure hunt itself, we all know, I'm not going to belabor this point, but everyone who's a listener knows how I feel about the value of having treasure hunt clues that are based in reality, real history, real things that are around us. And we don't get that either. So the lack of both of them bothers me. Maybe you could get away with one or the other, but you don't have either in Lara Croft.
Yeah. I fully agree with that. I think that I like it when treasure hunt movies are like relatable to some extent, and I think that, you know, it is part of, and we've talked about this before, right? Why we like National Treasure so much is because it feels like not something we should do, right? Like we shouldn't steal the Declaration of Independence. But it is made to look like it could be feasible. Like you're made to believe that Ben could do this with the resources that he has. And I think like this movie in particular, Lara Croft, to me, really just hit home the point that like as unrealistic as people like to say that National Treasure is, this movie is so much more unrealistic than that. And I would argue that like many of the films we have watched to compare to National Treasure are also equally unrealistic.
Yeah, very true.
So, last thing, that was, you know, we did your pet peeve, Supernatural. My pet peeve is action.
Yes.
So, how do we feel about the amount of action that like needs to be in a treasure hunt film?
Well, for me, watching this and all the other more traditional action movies that we compare National Treasure to makes me realize just how non-traditional and unique National Treasure is. There is so little good guy, bad guy fighting in National Treasure, which leaves so much more room for story and for plot compared to a movie like Lara Croft, where there's just tons of gunfights and like car, or in her case, motorcycle scenes and all of that kind of stuff. And I get it. I get that people who like an action flick, if they're like searching for an action flick to watch, they have that itch. They probably want to watch Lara Croft more than they want to watch National Treasure. There are people who think National Treasure is a little bit boring because it has so much plot. Was it John Turteltaub who mentioned how rare it was in an action movie to have a plot type scene in Urban Outfitters where Ben and Abigail are just conversing over the wall of the fitting room?
Yeah.
That is, to me, the argument. People might find that boring. I think it's a beautiful balance of how you can have an action movie that also has a plot grounded in, just like to tie it all together, grounded in a real world setting.
100%. I mean, I completely agree with you. I think in this movie, for me, there was too much action, and I feel that way about honestly most of the movies we've watched in comparison to National Treasure. I think, you know, to your point about the plot, like National Treasure definitely has more of a focus on solving clues
Yes.
than it does on action. And the solving clues is part of the plot, but that's very different than Lara Croft. And it's very different than The Mummy. Like, there were so many scenes in this film and other films where if I looked down, like, there was no way I was following what was happening because no one was talking. It was just fighting.
Right.
And, like, I want to solve the clues with the characters. I don't, even if I can't solve them because I can't. I want to be part of that. I don't like I'm never gonna see myself fighting robots. So like I don't know. And I hate to say this, but honestly, I feel like compared to National Treasure, in terms of like action versus plot and clue solving, would probably be the Da Vinci Code. I know we have mixed feelings about that, but there was a lot of clues there.
There's a very clear reason for that. The Da Vinci Code is not billed as an action movie.
And honestly, I don't understand why National Treasure is.
Well, it's billed as adventure slash action. So, in the end, I think this has been a really interesting conversation. Maybe we just spend a couple minutes in reflection. I feel like you've made your feelings about Lara Croft pretty clear.
Yeah, I did not like it. Aubrey, did you like it?
No, but
Okay.
I definitely didn't hate it as much as you did. I think you are really tainted by that opening scene.
I think so, honestly. I just,
Because
yeah.
there are this movie, compared to a lot of movies we've watched recently, especially The Mummy, and things like that, this movie had way more of a stepwise pattern. Like, you have to go to Cambodia, then you have to go to Venice, then you have to go to, like, was the Arctic or, you know,
The Arctic tundra.
somewhere like that. There was a very stepwise pattern here, and at least there was an order of operations to get to what is ultimately a treasure. It's not a treasure that I relate to, because I think of treasure, I think of something like the Templar treasure, but you found the thing, you know, et cetera. So I feel like this was way more analogous to National Treasure than a lot of things we've covered recently, but it wasn't my vibe.
Yeah, okay. I am starting to wonder in general if I would enjoy all of these films that we are comparing National Treasure to more if I watched them without trying to compare them to National Treasure.
Oh.
Because they are all so different from National Treasure, which I mean, it's something we highlighted in the last section, but National Treasure to me is the standard, and I think if I go into a movie looking for it to be a treasure hunt movie of that standard, it's not going to match up.
Yeah. I mean, also, I think the whole point of Parkington Lane is that it would now not even be possible for you to watch these without comparing them to National Treasure, even if you weren't watching them with the intent to prepare for a podcast episode.
Yeah, so thank you to this podcast for ruining other movies for me.
So, my big takeaway from all of this, are you ready for it, Emily?
I'm ready.
Watching this movie really made me wonder if Cross S. Nostrum was inspired by the Illuminati. Yeah, okay, so hear me out. They're portrayed in these two movies exactly the same. Literally, exactly the same. A board of old white men who are clearly in control of everything. They have one kind of spokesperson or one face doing their bidding in the real world, right? It's Powell for the Illuminati in Lara Croft, and it's Salazar for Cross S. Nostrum in Edge of History. But it's also this idea of just an entity working in the shadows that has been around since the beginning of time, this bigger than society vibe that both of them espouse, whether or not we agree with it. This hit me like a ton of bricks, and then I was like, oh my God. I think Cross S. Nostrum was inspired by the Illuminati, which was extremely jarring for me because, Emily, the last episode we recorded was our Cross S. Nostrum episode, and we were trying to ask ourselves, what would a Cross S. Nostrum look like in real life? And people think the Illuminati is real. I do not know enough. I do not have an educated opinion, but some people think it's real life. So in a way, could writing Cross S. Nostrum into Edge of History have been the Wibberleys' attempt at writing the Illuminati into a Disney property? Because it's probably a little edgy to put Illuminati in something like Edge of History, which is supposed to have a younger audience and things like that.
Oh. Can we ask them?
The Wibberleys, I think we have to.
Yeah. Oh. I can't top that, Aubrey. So we're gonna call it there.
Okay.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to this episode with us. And if you have thoughts on this movie, if I have completely insulted something you love near and dear, I guess you can talk to us about it, but like maybe try to be nice. You can find us on social media at NT Hunt Podcast. We're on Twitter and Instagram. Our website, nthuntpodcast.com, and you can join our Patreon at patreon.com/nthuntpodcast.
Hey, if any of you listening are joining us on this weekend's tour, we can't wait to see you. And if you can't make it this weekend, we hope we see you in the fall. And even if you can't come to Washington, D.C. to see us in person, we are coming at you with another new episode in just 2 weeks' time. We're doing a deep dive into Sor Juana, who we sort of met in an ethereal sense in Edge of History. So until then, everyone, I'm Aubrey.
And I'm Emily.
And thank you so much for joining us on our National Treasure Hunt.